Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have the start of the South Sudan peace deal at the same time as the South Sudanese refugee mob riots in western Ethiopia and hacks villagers to death. Riek Machar, the country's vice president and rebel leader, has finally returned to the capital of Juba to begin the long-awaited peace deal that was first agreed to last August. His country, one of the youngest in the world and formed after a successful decades-long American-supported insurgency, has been torn apart by a vicious civil war that immediately took on ethnic lines. Machar is a Nuer, while President Salva Kiir is a Dinka, and the two groups that they lead have been killing each other since 2013 when Kiir tried to remove Machar from his post. In the resulting aftermath, it's estimated that tens of thousands of people have been killed, hundreds of thousands have been made refugees in nearby countries, and over 1 million people have been displaced in the oil-rich but poverty-stricken country. Regional mediation spearheaded by Ethiopia and Uganda helped to bring the two sides to the negotiating table. And with Machar's return to the capital as part of the earlier agreed-to peace deal, it looks like the country's civil war might be finally ending for good. But where one conflict ends, another usually erupts. And there is a real risk that South Sudan's ethnic problems have already had an overspill effect in western Ethiopia's Gambela region. This part of the country is geographically and demographically quite small. It's about the size of Belgium, but only has around 300,000 people in it. It's known for its rich farmland, which quite a few multinational corporations have rented out, including some from the Gulf. And it's separated from the rest of the country by the long north-south mountain chain that runs through it. Actually, its flat plains connect directly to South Sudan, and this is why close to 300,000 South Sudanese refugees flooded into the region to escape the civil war. Most of them are ethnic Nuer, the same group as Vice President Machar, and they've gotten into land disputes with the local Anuaks. Tensions exploded immediately after a car accident when an NGO vehicle crashed into and killed two young girls. Right afterwards, an angry mob of refugees killed 10 people and injured another 13, with other reports saying that more people might have been hacked to death in the jungle as they were fleeing to escape. Just a week before that, some South Sudanese militants crossed into Ethiopia, slaughtered 200 people, and kidnapped over 100 children, prompting the military to chase them across the border in an effort to save them. It's unmistakable at this point that South Sudan's problems have affected Ethiopia, and as politically incorrect as it is to say this, the murderous South Sudanese refugee mob in Gambela proves that it is not racist, fascist, or white supremacist to say that overwhelming refugee influxes could possibly destabilize their host countries. The next one up is Daesh affiliate Abu Sayyaf beheading a Canadian hostage in the Philippines just 2 weeks before the country goes to the polls to choose a new leader. Four Western hostages were kidnapped last September by the ultra-radical Islamist insurgency group, popularly recognized as terrorists nowadays because of their pledge to Daesh. One of the abducted was John Ridsdale, and after his approximate $6.5 million ransom was not paid, the terrorist chopped off his head and delivered it to a nearby city center. Aside from sparking universal outrage, however, this horrible incident raises global attention about the simmering terrorist threat in the southern Philippines. To tersely review the history of the region, the island of Mindanao and its regional Sulu archipelago have a large indigenous Muslim population that has a different historical interpretation of events than their northern Christian neighbors. There were land disputes and discrimination claims all across the past century, and this eventually gave rise to an identity movement that favored either independence, autonomy, or some kind of special status for the region. With time, some elements of this movement took on the traits of Islamic fundamentalist and outright terrorist, especially around and after 9/11. I need to reiterate just to be clear, not all Mindanao activists are terrorists, but almost all terrorists in the Philippines operate in this region, and the government had earlier struck a limited autonomy deal with the legitimate Mindanao groups. Nevertheless, the Abu Sayyaf group continued to fester as a troublesome force, and they declared their allegiance to Daesh in January of this year. Prior to that, they were already carrying out killings, beheadings, and bombings. they've already been on the radar of security specialists for some time. And experts at last year's Shangri-La Dialogue event in Singapore warned about the emergence of a transnational terrorist hotspot in what they termed the Mindanao-Sulawesi Arc between the southern Philippines and the eastern provinces of Malaysia and Indonesia. Just recently, a spate of piracy attacks there, possibly linked to Abu Sayyaf or its supporters, has led Indonesia to halt coal exports through the region. And Jakarta just recently proposed doing joint patrols there with its Filipino and Malaysian counterparts in order to more tightly secure these waters. If the situation cannot be stabilized and more terrorism and piracy occurs in the area, there's a possibility that the U.S. might try to exploit all of this to more permanently station its naval forces in the waters, conveniently right on the southeastern reaches of the South China Sea. Japan, a new major ally of the Philippines, might also try to jump in as well. So why is all this important? Well, the Philippines chooses its next president on the 9th of May. And the unlikely outsider and former mayor of a Mindanao city, Rodrigo Duterte, is leading in the polls. He's pledged to be pragmatic and not incite China. And he in many ways has already started an unprecedented people's movement in the Philippines. If he becomes president, the country might have a completely different future than just returning to its former American vassal status, which it's currently on track to do. But let's just hope that the new outbreak of terrorism and piracy in the southern Philippines, which is completely out of his control, is not manipulated by his opponents and used to dent his image and throw off his surging popularity on the eve of elections. Third in our countdown is the Turkish Parliament Speaker's lobbying effort to remove secularism from the country's nearly centennial-old constitution and replace it with the religious state. This is not a surprise at all. I mean, any capable expert knew that it was imminent if Erdogan won re-election. But Turkish Parliament Speaker İsmail Karaman came out and openly decried the country's secularist constitution and called for Turkey's transformation into a legalized Islamic state. Now, don't get me wrong here. There's nothing wrong with the country choosing to incorporate religious fundamentals into its government. I mean, Iran, Pakistan, and Mauritania already have. But when you're a traditionally secularist state, as per the vision of your modern-day founder, in this case Mustafa Kemal, who later gained the honorary surname Ataturk, or Father of the Turks, then that's a major, major revisionist problem. Don't forget that although Erdogan's AK party is Islamist, and the Turkish president is very close in working in ideological terms of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is officially declared as a terrorist organization by Russia, Syria, and even Saudi Arabia, nearly half of the country is secular and does not want to have Islamic law forced onto them. Sure, the legal system of all countries in the region is to one degree or another influenced by religious teachings, but there's a huge difference between being a secular republic like Syria and being a Wahhabi monarchy like Saudi Arabia. And Turkey is tilting towards the latter as Erdogan consolidates the rest of his power by shaping up to become a sultan, who historically has been seen by his flock as being the main Islamic leader of the world. Look, folks, Turkey is already in trouble. It has the civil war against the Kurds in the southeast, occasional Daesh terrorist attacks in its major cities, gray wolf nationalists intimidating the secular opposition, the progressive elimination of all forms of freedom of speech in the country, over 1 million refugees and economic migrants running throughout the country, a crippled economy, and unnecessary tensions with Russia and Syria. The absolute last thing that the Turkish people need at this critical moment is a secularist Islamist confrontation, especially one which spills out in the streets. Because you know what, guys? That might be the straw that breaks the camel's back and throws this recently destabilized country into the throes of a multi-sided civil war on top of the one that's already going on in the southeast against the Kurds. A conflict unprecedented in the country's history and which would either bloodily drag on indefinitely or be solved by a restorative military coup. I hope that neither of these things happen, of course. I mean, despite differences between our political leaders, I have nothing wrong with the Turkish people at all. And I do not wish this sort of destabilizing tragedy on anyone. But let's be real here. Officially turning secular Turkey into an Islamic state can and will cause serious domestic tensions precisely at the moment when the country is more unstable than it ever has been since independence. Our runner-up are the spate of missile tests that have happened over the past 2 weeks or so, with Russia, China, and even North Korea testing their latest wares as an unmistakable deterrent measure against American aggression. So guys, maybe you read about one or two of these tests before, but I doubt that you've connected them all together like I have. And here's what's been going on lately. Russia just tested a hypersonic glide vehicle, which will allow it to evade the U.S.'s destabilizing so-called missile defense shield and preserve the nuclear strategic parity between the two great powers. This is huge because the Pentagon had wanted to offset Russia's nuclear second strike capability by building this sort of infrastructure and outfitting mobile, mostly ship-based units with these capabilities, which, if it wasn't counteracted, would have put the U.S. in a position to nuclear blackmail Russia. The next thing that we saw happening is that reports came out that China tested its Dongfeng 41 hypersonic missile, the world's longest range ICBM, which could travel 7,450 miles in only half an hour, or basically send a payload from Beijing to London or Honolulu in that time. And finally, the last test that happened was North Korea's sub-based missile launch, which, while nowhere near as spectacular as Russia and China's and done outside of the framework of international law, no matter how normally justified it was, also turned heads all across the world. So let me just put it all into perspective here for you guys. Russia has proven that it has the technological capabilities to counteract the U.S.'s falsely labeled missile defense infrastructure without falling into the trap of an expensive arms race. And China has shown that it has world-class military capabilities that isn't to be messed with. North Korea, on the other hand, is doing what it's doing in order to bring the U.S. back to the negotiating table and hopefully convince it to call off its regular and very provocative war games with South Korea in exchange for Pyongyang halting its nuclear program. To do that, it wants to demonstrate its various launch capabilities, no matter how incipient and underdeveloped, in order to hammer home the point that it can and will respond to American aggression and express its sovereign right to defend itself. Now again, guys, do not get me wrong. As much as I personally applaud North Korea for what it's doing, I do know that it violates the UNSC resolutions, which Russia and China helped pass, and that it might miserably backfire by only giving the U.S. an excuse to dig in its heels and double down on its military presence in South Korea, including with possible so-called anti-missile technology. But all in all, these past 2 weeks saw three very important missile tests from Russia, China, and North Korea, which confirmed that multipolar states will not accept being pushed around and treated as subordinates by the U.S. At our top spot, we've got India's uncharacteristically clumsy and highly embarrassing diplomatic gaffe in giving a tourist visa to an Uyghur separatist leader who China accuses of terrorism, only to revoke the decision a few days later amidst the global scandal that followed. I can't tell you how disappointed I was in India when I learned that they had issued an electronic tourist visa for Dulquan Isa, one of the leaders of the self-proclaimed World Uyghur Congress and an individual who's wanted by China for terrorist charges. It actually hurts me to see India, the South Asian anchor of the BRICS community and the general multipolar world, siding so closely with the U.S. in international security matters. I mean, they just hosted U.S. Defense Secretary Carter, agreed in principle to the logistics support agreement that I spoke about previously on Context Countdown, and also decided to work together on building India's first ever domestically manufactured aircraft carrier. But imagine my happy surprise when India walked back its decision and announced that the Uyghur terrorist would not be receiving his visa. I was so proud of India. I mean, it honestly made me smile the moment that I read that. But guys, this incident says a lot about India and the power struggle that's going on in its Ministry of External Affairs and government in general. And I'm here to put it all into context and tell you what's happening and why. India and China are in a cold war for influence that stretches all across the Indian Ocean region, South Asia, ASEAN, and even soon, possibly in Central Asia as well. The latest incident between the two was when India asked the UN to declare Masood Azhar, who's accused of masterminding the January terrorist attack on the Pathankot Air Force Base, as a terrorist. China obviously blocked the measure because it was against the internationalization of the bilateral dispute between India and Pakistan, and also would never do anything to interfere in the sovereign affairs of its decades-long and time-tested ally, let alone when it's in the process of constructing the $46 billion China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, a crucial spoke in the One Belt, One Road project. India knows how close China and Pakistan are, and I believe that it staged this UN public relations stunt in order to get Beijing to turn on Islamabad, smear Beijing as a passive supporter of terrorism, which its media was doing, or normatively justify what I think was a pre-planned response to give the Uyghur terrorist Issa a visa. Even though that visa was later revoked, the conference of the so-called Uyghur World Congress and other anti-Chinese groups, which was planned to be held in the northern city of Dharamsala, is still going to go ahead, which raises an important question. Why is India hosting Chinese separatists, which Beijing accuses of terrorism? And if it's going to proceed with this conference, why revoke Issa's visa? Well, guys, it just shows that there's a power struggle going on behind the scenes between multipolar and unipolar supporters, with each vying to influence India in its 21st century geopolitical course. The multipolar ones won a minor victory with the visa revocation, but ultimately, the unipolar ones have come out on top because the hostile conference of anti-Chinese separatists has not been scrapped. Keep an eye on the China-India Cold War, guys, and India's unipolar tilt, because you know what? It's getting very serious. Okay, guys, so there we have it. This is the end of this week's very interesting and very diverse episode of Context Countdown. As always, I want to thank you guys for listening to my program, and please, if you can, I encourage you to share it on social media. Thanks again. I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend, and hopefully you'll tune in again next week. Take care. Bye.